currently their chair, as well as an active participant in numerous standards committee, including chairmanship of the 24TB-01 Lip Sync Ad Hoc Group. He currently has several patents applied for and granted. He's a member of IEEE and SMPTE. He cycles in the summer and curls in the winter and has been a year-round radio amateur since 1972. Paul Briscoe.
Thank you. Is this mic on? Okay, it is. Well, good morning, everybody, and enjoy your breakfast as I stand up here and chatter at you. Thank you so much for coming and joining me this morning. It's wonderful to address a crowd who actually understands what curling means, and it's beyond tragic. I go other places and speak, and people go, curling, but you have straight hair, so they don't really get it, but you all know why I'm wearing the knee brace. It's the beginning of the curling season. That's the way that goes. So I'd like to talk about a couple of topics today, and I don't have a clicker. First and foremost, I'm going to talk to you about the lip sync issue and a solution that's underway that may help us eventually and finally solve the problem throughout the production chain. And also going to talk a little bit about AFD, something that's a little more in hand. Both of these are SMPTE arenas for standardization. AFD is an existing standard now. Lip sync is an up-and-coming standard, and I can tell you a little bit about the progress of our committee with that work. So if everybody's got their eyes lined up with the bars, I must make one blanket apology. It's not really an apology. I'm very pleased to announce that Harris Broadcast is now a standalone company and no longer part of the Harris Corporation. And as such, we have lots of good things going on inside. However, one not-so-good thing that went on was the insistence that I use a template provided by corporate for these slides. So as we go through, you'll see a couple of things, including fonts, changing things, moving around. Please don't be alarmed. It's all okay. This template also has this disclaimer attached, which I'm supposed to present. However, they never said that I was supposed to leave it up long enough for you to read it, nor was I to read it to you. So we're going to move on now, having met my commitment. So let's have a chat about lip sync and what's going on with lip sync. We're not talking about this kind of lip sync, nor are we talking about this kind, my favorite kind of lip sync. Oh, come on, best movie ever. We're talking about this kind of lip sync, the kind that affects us every day. Every station engineer sits at home and watches their output, and every so often goes, oh, what's happening? And it's a big problem. So let's chat about why it's a big problem and what we can do about solving it. The big deal, of course, is that the sound and picture aren't temporally aligned. I've tried for a long time to learn a little bit of ventriloquism so I could demonstrate that to people, but I can't. But you all know what that's about. And there's varying impact depending on the content. And it depends really very tightly on what the content is. If you have music or sound effects or close-up dialogue, then the problem can be very, very difficult. It really depends on what you can see. If you can't see anybody talking or see anything moving, there's no lip sync problem. A slightly bigger issue with it is this issue of directionality. We're all from birth programmed to understand that sound is slower than light. And in the physical universe, that's what happens to us. So when you're sitting way back in the nosebleeds and the bat hits the ball, you fully expect to hear the sound a little bit later. If that were to be reversed, as happens sometimes with lip sync, that's very inorganic to our brains, and that hurts a lot. And that's one of the things that makes lip sync a big problem. The other issue that is problematic is a hysteresis effect. When you're watching a show, you're watching some content, and you notice something fall out of lip sync. Once your brain's been triggered, it's very hard to go back and not see that. It can't be unseen, as my daughter would say. So it's a problem because of diminished viewer experience. This is the person, the audience we're ultimately trying to entertain, we're trying to satisfy with our work. And their enjoyment of it and their quality of experience is really, really badly affected. And it can be things as minor as irritation. It's annoying, and we don't really want to do that to viewers. They may change their channel. They may pay less attention to what's going on. They may simply ignore it. And advertisers aren't really big on that, especially if the show has bad lip sync and they've been triggered and they're annoyed and now the commercial comes on, it's just fine. They're still annoyed sitting there watching the commercial. Another big problem is the loss of suspension of disbelief. You're watching something, you're quite immersed in what's going on. It's a fantasy, that's the whole idea. And all of a sudden this jars you and it knocks you out of your little happy place where you're watching your content. And studies have indicated as well there's a potential loss of believability of content. And I have George up here for a reason, because watching his lips was very important to him, and if they were out of sync with his words, how believable would he be? And advertisers really, and presidents as well, really don't like that. And it's not a new problem. This goes back to the very early days of motion media. As soon as we married up sound and picture in motion, the piano player had to watch the movie and keep up with the movie. When we got to talking movies, we had separate sound and video tracks, sound and picture tracks. We had to somehow keep them synchronized. Manual operation, problematic. Even with modern film, we have discrete processes with video and, images going down one path, sound going down another, and then, of course, post-production and all the chopping and cutting that goes on, it all has to be brought back together. Television wasn't so bad at first. It was all very immediate. The raster scanned off the camera, the microphone picked up the audio, they just went straight to your set and went back on the screen within, tens of microseconds of each other. But then it got worse. We got into post-production, we got into digital technology, which introduces latency, and then more digital technology, which is systems full of this latency, and then still more digital technology when compression came to the forefront, because it takes time to compress video and audio and decompress them and so on. And then it gets even worse with this thing called the internet. And there's exacerbating factors, such as the rich content we have today with HD, the less formal shooting styles can suddenly have a close-up. Multi-camera shoots and so on can result in different audio and video delays into the production system. HD, of course, is a big problem because you can see more that can trigger lip sync noticeability. TV sets are now complicated. Home theater systems can have a separate audio and video path, and you don't know how things are going to break at that end. Our systems today are extremely complicated. We use compression for everything now. You can have signal processing that's been uncorrected for. You can go through a whole bunch of latent processing in one path and not correct the other path without thinking about it if you're not careful. And then we have complex and we have multiple distribution architectures, so leaving your output spigot, it may be great. As it's distributed down the various food chains, things may break. And probably the biggest exacerbating factor is viewer awareness. Even my mother-in-law, who watches TV, now knows what lip sync is all about, and she doesn't know I work with this stuff. She said to me, "What goes on when that happens? I see that and it annoys me." And viewer awareness is probably one of the bigger problems now. So there's a trigger phenomenon. This is you can't unsee it once it's been seen. It moves your acceptability threshold. And in lip sync, a number of years ago, the ITU did a study, and there's a little chart here I'll show you, slightly bigger in a second, which shows what was originally thought about acceptability and how we've evolved in that thinking. And this trigger phenomenon, it may only occur infrequently. You may only see a lip sync trigger from time to time in the image. And if the lip sync's okay, this isn't a problem. But if the lip sync is slightly bad and then you see a trigger, you can't unsee it, and it sticks in your brain, it takes time to reset your brain. And this can traverse content. So the show is out of lip sync, the commercial comes on, it's in lip sync, but you're already steamed, you're not enjoying it, and you don't automatically reset your brain. So the ITU and the ATSC have looked at this. ITU originally came up with this blue line that said it wasn't really detectable unless you were your audio was early by about a frame or late by a handful of frames, which is kind of interesting, but it reflects the natural human experience. The ATSC looked at this and said, no, that's nowhere near good enough. We're going to allow a couple of frames late and a frame early, not much more than that. And this is what's captured in IS 191, but even this isn't so great. There's the original thresholds, and in fact, film, of course, plus and minus a frame is considered barely tolerable. And the modern acquisition specifications are quite interesting. I grabbed PBS's acquisition specification, which basically says you're allowed to be not quite a frame either way. I think the actual spec reads plus or minus half a frame. Now, you might argue, how can you measure lip sync with a half a frame? There's frames come at frame rate. But obviously, if you consider temporally how far things can get out, you are able to measure. We'll talk about how the new standard can do that. But the green band in the middle now shows what really modern thinking conveys about lip sync. It has to be that tight. The old thinking about lip sync is gone. Where can it happen? Well, it can happen throughout your facility. Here's just some equipment hooked in series and different places this stuff can happen. On compressed links, for example, the video server, your entire facility infrastructure could have places in it. Branding and processing, of course, at your output side, and even then going down the pipe and coming back for confidence monitoring. All these places can introduce lip sync. So imagine you're getting to your transmitter perfectly and your return feed has an error. Back in master control, the operator's going, oh, I have a lip sync problem. One example of a problem source is a frame sync, and this is a good example of the trigger phenomenon. These things fix video timing by dropping or repeating frames when locked to a new reference. And one frame sync may not be a problem, but when you concatenate frame syncs in a system, and I don't mean plug one to the next, but you have a bunch of devices that involve two frame sync operations, you can end up with a situation where occasionally the peak delay, as shown in the right, gets to the point where it triggers the viewer's sensitivity to lip sync. So typically frame syncs, as we all know, use audio matching delays to keep the audio in line with the video. But if it's a video-only system with audio going down a separate path, you potentially have the problem now of generating a trigger without really thinking about it. And when you go and measure most of the time, the lip sync's not that bad, except occasionally it pops up. Now, we can spread the blame around. It isn't just frame syncs. It's any piece of equipment that has any amount of substantial latency in it. Vision mixers, especially with DVEs and reentry. Routing switchers, they used to be transparent. Today, they have integrated frame syncs and processing and audio muxing and demuxing and yada, yada. Cameras, of course, used to be pretty fast. The beam would scan the tubes and up would go the video. Now, of course, there's sensor latency involved with sensor image capture and image transfer and processing. Up, down, and cross conversion, we all live with this today. Compression, both ends of compression take time. The variability of the viewing environment, not only in your station, in your screening rooms, in your control rooms, but at home. You have no idea what's happening at home. And I like this little sentence. The end-to-end system from acquisition through production and distribution to final viewing provides many opportunities for AV asynchrony. In other words, many ways to break it. And it isn't just at our end of the world. This is a study that was done in Europe with set-top boxes to see how they behaved. The manufacturer names have been removed to protect the innocent. But as you can see, there's a little bit of variance in set-top boxes. This is kind of scary in and of itself. And it also depends. From the top to the bottom, these are different manufacturers, and within the manufacturers, these are different models of their product, and you can see that there's quite a range of performance. So why is it so bad? Well, we don't really have standards. We do this by humans. Somebody watches it, somebody, hopefully a trained expert, is watching in a controlled environment and keeps their eye out for what's going on. And not on live content, typically. On produced content, maybe, when you're screening a show or whatever, but what goes on air, you don't have a body watching it full time. So there's no really universal, interoperable way to measure lip sync problems, especially when in service. We can take our systems out of service and put beeps and flashes down the system. They come out the other end, we can measure them. But you can't do that to the viewer during the middle of prime time, yet you want to know if there's a problem. There's also a lack of standards for the distributor and the consumer. MPEG is a very interesting standard. The MPEG standard very explicitly tells you how to create timestamps associated with content. What it does not tell you in a normative way, in a you must do it way, is how a decoder shall use those timestamps. They assumed quite reasonably that we'll build a standard that describes how the signal is built, and people will use that information to build the proper decoders. What they didn't consider was the fact that ASIC chips are expensive to develop. Silicon is cheaper today, and 10 seconds later, it's even cheaper, but it still takes a lot of giblets to put inside a chip to get this job done. And so they can cut some corners handling timestamps. Nah, we won't worry about it, it's close enough. Recently, the CEA has actually published CEB20. This is a document which attempts to describe in a normative manner how decoders shall use the MPEG timestamps. So this is a good advancement. This may help fix the MPEG distribution system. Traditionally then, what do? We acquire AV in sync, and then we manage the differentials manually throughout the chain. So you go into post with all your stuff, it was captured with a clapperboard, you know it's all good. In post, you keep an eye on it. Coming out of post, you keep an eye on it. And we do it locally. In systems, we pre-offset the AV. You may put in a fixed delay somewhere in a system because you know that the paths that the media has to traverse are differential. So you fix them with a piece of fixed delay in the shorter of the two paths so that they work in a predictable manner. We put humans at key points in the workflow, and as we all know today, there's less and less humans in the workflow, as there probably should be. I don't think this is a reasonable job for anybody to watch TV 24/7 or at least for an 8-hour shift, and try and decide if lip sync has been maintained with every frame. We can tell the viewer who calls, oh, looks good leaving here, it must be your set, and today it's probably more true than it ever was, if they can find somebody to call. But these won't solve end-to-end problems. They can help minimize them, and this is how we've been struggling along all these years. Careful system design and careful equipment selection is the key to limiting the problem. But the key word here is limiting, not solving. So we do it with human eyes, subjective eyes, variable eyes, and opinionated eyes. So the guy working the morning shift may do a really good job of your lip sync monitoring. The guy working the afternoon shift, maybe not so much. And it's only valid at the time and at the point of measurement, and only valid for the content you're looking at. So it's a one-time, one-shot operation. There are automated techniques, but most of them require, for example, the upstream insertion of some kind of marker into the content, perhaps a watermark in the audio and video, something invisible that can be found later in the content and used to make a measurement. Many of these don't have system-level robustness. Watermarks are brilliant and wonderful until you take a video watermark and you down-convert it from HD to SD and then go to analog and put it through some processing and then resample it and so on. These things can get lost very quickly. They're also typically proprietary systems. There's a number of manufacturers that make them, and they all work really well within themselves, and they don't work with each other by design. There's a lot of patents in this arena as well. These are not system-wide solutions, but they can span more than a single point. And some of them can drive automatic correction, others can't. So we can do a couple of things today. We can do out-of-service measurements. And in these couple of slides, green is good, yellow's not so good, and red is kind of bad. Out-of-service is very simple. You put a beep and a flash down the line, you have a look at it at the other end. You can automate that kind of thing, and there are vendor solutions around that. And at the time of the use of that technique, it's pretty foolproof. If things do change later on, though, you don't know. You only know at the instant you measured. And they still have human involvement at some level. You can't use them in the content. Out-of-service measurements mean out-of-service. That content is put aside while you do your measurements. So you can't use it on air. You can't use it in real time. At 2 in the morning, you can throw it on the transmitter and see what happens. So typically, this is acquisition, editing, system testing stuff. There is in-service measurement equipment available. As I mentioned before, we can use it on air within content. It comes from various manufacturers. A few of them are listed on the right. To varying degrees of success and varying degrees of capability. They're only for use within the broadcast plant. Once you get outside the broadcast plant, most of these techniques are no longer available for use. They have differing degrees of complexity, and many of them will not traverse all processing. It's all great until you go from HD to SD or put it through MPEG, and all of a sudden the process breaks. These typically are box or module level solutions. They're not sufficiently simple that you can stick it on a BNC input or output port of, say, a routing switcher, because the cost of the technology inside is too high. And these are non-standardized. This is the reason they don't work together or play nicely with anybody but themselves. So what do we need? Bullets are all green. We need a standardized in-service measurement. And obviously, an in-service measurement will work in an out-of-service manner as well, right? We want to be able to use it on the air with live content. We want to be able to buy our product from different manufacturers. So if you're tired of buying mine, which of course I hope you would never become, you can go to another vendor and buy his product knowing that we'll play nicely together. We want to use the same techniques everywhere within the solution. We want a low degree of complexity. We want to put this on any port of a device. We want to be able to offer, as a manufacturer, I want to be able to offer a customer a product that they can use universally, use broadly, and not have to look at the capital cost of boxes or modules to solve this problem. If you can put it throughout your system, you can take best advantage of it. We want to work everywhere in the chain, not just in plant, but we want to do something that can be used once we hand off that signal by other technologies downstream to solve the problem right to the viewer's eyes and ears. And it has to traverse all the processing. No matter what happens to that signal, we need to be able to, at the far end, as far as possible down the chain, and in my mind, right at the viewer's living room, get the information back and be able to measure AV sync. So, standards to the rescue, SMPTE in this case. Standardized solution obviously will enable interoperability. And there is a SMPTE standardization activity underway. As Leonard mentioned, I chair the committee working on this, and I'll tell you a little bit about our progress shortly. We base this on a technology called fingerprinting. This is not at all like watermarking, where you take some identifier and hide it inside the content. What we want to do in this case is actually measure the content and identify unique things in the content, like a fingerprint that we can extract and hold in our hand as a piece of metadata. And then we want to associate that metadata with the essence. So we're not touching the essence, we're not modifying it. What we're doing is we're actually extracting a unique fingerprint from the essence, from the video frame by frame, from the audio sample by sample, and grabbing that metadata in our hand. What we then do downstream is take the video and audio content, which may have moved in time, and we fingerprint again. We extract those same fingerprints from the content. And we also bring downstream with the content the fingerprints we grabbed upstream when we knew the content was in good condition. Now we have a set of correct fingerprints and a set of audio-video misaligned fingerprints. And we can take those two sets of fingerprints and make some measurements without touching the content or without having to extract from the content. We can measure using the metadata and understand what's happened to our content. So from a system point of view, it kind of looks like this. We have audio-video programs. We extract the fingerprints from the audio and video content. And then we put that content through some production system, delivery system, whatever we're doing. And somewhere downstream, we fingerprint again. We extract those very same fingerprints. And then we do a comparison. And the comparison of those fingerprints provides us with information about the audio-video delay. Here's a little more detail on it. So what we actually do then is we extract a video fingerprint, and then when there's multiple audio channels, in fact, we can extract multiple audio fingerprints. This is kind of an interesting thing, and there's some debate about how important this is, and I won't dwell on it. If you have five language tracks on a piece of material, and they're all spoken word, only one of them is actually going to convey lip sync, because the other four languages don't reflect the movement of the lips. If, however, you have five mixes in five languages of a movie, the voices may be overdubbed, but all the sound effects are the same. So you still want to be able to handle multiple audio channels. So we fingerprint the video and audio, we push it through the system, we fingerprint it again, and then elsewhere in the system, possibly at the endpoint, most likely, or possibly somewhere else in a monitoring system, we can compare the upstream and downstream fingerprints, so we can tell about overall delay, and we can tell about the actual lip sync error. So for video fingerprint generation, we do something really simple. We take the picture and we downscale it. We don't want to look at every pixel. What we're looking for is changes from frame to frame. Our fingerprinting is based on what's changed from the last frame to this frame. And we do a very, very simple downscale, and we get 960 points. We pick 960 pixels off the screen. And you may say, well, that's not very many pixels for an HD picture. No, it's not. But what we're trying to do is find big blobs of stuff that are changing in a big way from frame to frame. Remember, we don't need to establish lip sync every frame. We need to establish an opinion about lip sync over time. So 10, 20, 30 frames, doesn't matter how long it takes to find the triggers. Once you start to find these changes, we can look downstream and correlate them. It's not necessarily an instantaneous process. It's a process that can take its time. And as things change in the system, it can follow that. So what we do is we take a frame, and then we take the next frame, and we take these 960 points per frame, and we look at what's changed. And we establish a change threshold. And in fact, our change threshold is 32. So if the pixel value changes by more than 32 from one frame to the next, we consider that a significant change, and we record a 1. And then we look at the next pair of pixels, and if they haven't changed, we record a 0, and so on, until we count up all 960 pixels to figure out how many have changed significantly. And that gives us something we call a change index. It's a measure of how much change has gone on in the picture. Now notice we're not looking at motion, we're not looking at anything critical. We're just looking at luma and only 960 points. But that seems to be enough in the testing that's been done to convey enough about picture change to do the job effectively. And then we normalize this down to a byte. What we want to do is come up with a small piece of metadata. The goal here is not to generate a giant stream of data as big as the media. We want to generate something small. So we pull it down to a byte. So every video frame that goes by, we generate one byte of change index with a value of 0 to 255, which describes how much change has gone on. In audio, we do something somewhat similar. We take the audio and we feed it into two processes, one of which generates an envelope waveform, which is obviously a fast rectification of the audio. And then we also look at a mean, which is a low-pass filter, an integrated version of the same thing. And then on an audio sample-by-sample basis, we look at whether the envelope is above or below the mean. Cheap and dirty, really simple. And it generates a string of ones and zeros, which we gather up sample-by-sample. And then we subsampled them, because we don't really need huge temporal resolution here. We've aimed at 1 millisecond accuracy. So we can place audio within a millisecond of the video using the downsampling we're using. And what we come up with is something on the order of 923 bits per second for a 48K sample rate. So about 115 bytes per second. And this is the metadata associated with the audio that we transport along with our 30 frames, 2997 frames of video per second. And then we put them in a little payload container. And the payload container contains other little bits of information. You can see here, they're not particularly important for what I'm conveying to you right now. But the audio and video fingerprint data is in there, plus a checksum, plus some other little bits to help the system work. And then this payload container is shipped along with the essence down the system. Now, further on down the pipe, we need to do some comparison. So from the video point of view, on the left in the blue box, we have the upstream program A, the downstream program B, and the bars you see are the values of the change index. Now, as you can see, they're offset in time. There's going to be some video delay, sure. However, you can do some correlation now and identify these patterns, the fact that they're the same and they've moved. And now you can put a tag on where the video is, both upstream and down. In audio, we do the same. We look at the change index, and we do a correlation. And the correlation allows us to find the same point in the two streams, even though they're temporally separate. This slide's in the wrong place, but it'll all make sense. The payload, we transport several ways. We can transport it over SDI. We carry it in VANC packets, ST291 VANC packets, regular old vertical ancillary data, with a unique and registered DID and SDID. This is the address that describes what the VANC packet is. It becomes inherently bound to the essence. This is really nice in SDI because the metadata is glued to the content at this point. So if audio-video sync fails for whatever reason, that's okay, the metadata is still stuck to it. We can do something downstream. And it's lossless and error-free as much as SDI is error-free. Who in this room thinks SDI is error-free? I'm always curious about this question. Oh, I set you up by saying that, didn't I? SDI is not error-free, of course, but it's close enough for things we want. Over an MPEG transport stream, we can do the same thing. We can stick this in a private PID and push it over MPEG, the same payload. It'll arrive at the decoder with timestamps on it, and it doesn't matter if it's a little misaligned from the video audio anyway, because the correlator will find it. Again, it's also lossless and error-free in so much as transport streams can be error-free. We can also transport it over IP as a UDP packet. We just stick it on the network. Now, it's very indirectly bound to the essence now. We're just pushing it out, and we generate it, the video goes somewhere, we push this out onto the network. We push it out with an IP address and a payload ID and an ID descriptor so it can be identified later on. Here it may be errored, here it may be lost. Things may go bad in the IP network. So we need to reassociate it at the receiver, but we don't really care because, again, it's a long-term slow correlation we're doing with this stuff. And we want to look at binding it to files, single part files such as an AVI, or multi-part files in the second slide, which is something like an MXF container. And as you'll see in a second when I talk to you about the standardization, this is something we still haven't decided the entire scope of, but clearly it has great use in the file system world. So SMPTE's working on a standardized solution. We have a working group, and our mandate is to establish a technology and draft a standard. The technology was put forward by our good friends at Miranda in Canada, and they've tested this extensively, and they've offered it for use in the SMPTE standard, and it seems to work pretty well. We built a test kit, we've shipped it around, and various people have played with it and found good results. The requirements of the SMPTE process are we need fingerprinting algorithms for video and audio that meet the performance requirements we've established, which is a millisecond measurement capability, and transport over the four transports I just described to you, plus binding to files. So the draft standard is called ST2064. I don't know if I should tell you that yet. I'm not sure about the SMPTE rules, but it'll be out pretty soon. Multiple parts, and the two key parts that we're talking about today are part one, which is the generation of the fingerprint, and part two, which is the transport of the fingerprint. We're now starting work on the file binding as we go to ballot on the other parts. And here's where we are right now, actually. The part one document, the fingerprint and payload, was finished. We've received all our comments, and we're about to go to ballot on that. Part two, the drafting is done. Our pre-ballot review just completed. We'll be going to ballot together with part one fairly shortly. And so that's imminent. Part three drafting, which is the file binding we're working on, and that's underway. We hope to complete that this quarter. And then we want to follow up with CEA, EBU, and ITU because we can push this stuff beyond us. The same technology, the same fingerprinting, can work in the consumer domain. So if the CEA were to adopt this and push this payload to the home, there is now a way to actually fix the problem right in the viewer's living room. And it can work in IRDs, set-top box, right in TV sets, PCs and web devices even. This fingerprint data it's medium agnostic, it's transport agnostic, it simply relates to the picture and sound. We need to define additional transports for this, and this is outside SMPTE, and hence we have liaisons to these other organizations to try and see if they want to use this. And so far the interest level from them is very, very high. So, in summary, this is a technique that has been selected by SMPTE for standardization to provide an interoperable solution. Oh, I got a big bullet, I'll hold that. And we can span it right from acquisition when you clap the clapper board, potentially right to the viewer's home. It works in service on live content, super simple to implement. The techniques I talked about that we do to actually make the measurements are very straightforward and cheap to implement, and it's very, very robust. It's been tested across compression, multiple compressions, up and down conversion, adding of lower thirds, all manner of stuff, and it still eventually will correlate and find the content. And it's interoperable. It's the best and most exciting part of all. I can build a product, you can build a product, our products will play nicely together. So we hope this will be coming real soon to LipSync carriers near you. Now, let's talk about a slightly older problem. This is more under control, but also asked to say a few words on this, and that's format, specifically aspect ratio. So what's the problem? Well, the problem is there's more than one aspect ratio. I'm going to focus just on two in talking about it here. The two that we're most interested in, of course, are 4x3 and 16x9. And the problem is like this. Without aspect ratio management, what happens? Well, you produce 16x9 and you broadcast 4x3 letterbox. And what does the viewer see? Well, the viewer sees 4x3 letterbox with side panels. Or you produce 4x3 and you broadcast 16x9 with side panels. What does the viewer see? Well, they see letterbox, side panel, postage stamp, pictures. Or you may transmit 4x3 and broadcast 4x3 and the viewer has a fancy expensive set and they want to light up every pixel on that screen. I know my mother-in-law, she wants that. She doesn't like the picture not filling the screen. Well, they stretch the heck out of it. It lights those pixels. I paid for those pixels, damn it. So with AFD, what we really want to achieve is this. No matter how you broadcast it, you still want the screen at the other end to look correct. So you don't want what's under the X's, and you don't want what's actually being broadcast. You want what's actually representable by the set at the far end. So the problem is the double-ended problem. Your source content may be in either format. In your archive, everybody's got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of archive in 4x3. Your network may feed you one, it may feed you the other. This problem is a little less now in North America, now that we're over the analog hump. In the rest of the world, this is still a very big problem. And the evolutionary transition, less of a problem here again in North America, but the rest of the world, still a very, very big issue. And you may have to simulcast in both formats. We've all been through that. Thankfully, that era is a little behind us. Unless you happen to be feeding more than just a stick, you may be feeding various cable and other distribution systems. You may be feeding basic cable that wants an SD feed. So how do you satisfy all of this? Well, you do it with this standard called AFD. We need a method, and this is what AFD does, of conveying the native aspect ratio of the picture essence with respect to its carrier raster. Okay, so we have two pieces in play here. And we can have a number of things. We can have 16x9 or 4x3 inside their respective carriers. We can have 4x3 inside 16x9 in different ways. It can be stretched anamorphically, it can be sitting in the center. And the same thing, we can have 16x9 inside 4x3. Same thing here, it can be stretched vertically, anamorphically, or it can be letterboxed. There's a whole bunch of ways to mess up a picture without thinking about it. So AFD literally means active format description, not descriptor, by the way, it's description. And it's metadata that describes the format of the signal. It can be carried with the signal all throughout the production process, right through emission, and after emission with other standards, it can be carried down to the far end. It specifies the carrier frame's aspect ratio and the characteristics of the active image within that frame. The metadata is carried in SDI and the vertical ancillary data, just like the lip sync. And it's designed to automatically control aspect ratio conversion to downstream devices. Although strictly it's designed to allow measurement and establishment of what's going on, but the real purpose, of course, is to allow fixing the problem. So the two elements are the carrier, the coded frame in the parlance of the standard. This is the actual picture that's in your transport. So if you have HD SDI, your carrier transport, your coded frame is 16 by 9. Within that, you may have an active image that's 4 by 3. So this is the active image inside the coded frame. And the standard, SMPTE 2016, the AFD standard, specifies both the raster format and the active image format. And these are the two pieces of the puzzle we have to manage. So what we do now is we convey using these little AFD codes, and it's a 4-bit code. It's a very tiny little bit of metadata, but that code describes the relationship between the transport carrier and the frame inside it, the coded frame and the active image. And there's actually two sets of 4-bit codes. One of them, if you have a 16 by 9 transport, the other 4-bit codes if you have a 4 by 3 transport, because obviously the transformations are different to each other. These codes are embedded into the content. And then when an aspect ratio converter or an up-down converter is fed with this content, the metadata is picked off and used to tell it how to handle the picture. What do you do with that picture? And that allows then, when you go from a 16 by 9 to a 4 by 3, it allows the 16 by 9 to come up full screen, for example, and the 4 by 3 to be letterboxed appropriately. Goes into vertical ancillary. There's where it goes in SD, and there's where it goes in HD. As a side note, only in the Y channel of HD, just for esoteric HD reasons. And it needs to be very early in the vertical interval, so you can actually grab it and get handling it before the video arrives, because you want to be sure your aspect ratio converter is set up to convert correctly by the time the video, first line of active video arrives. SMPTE says that the metadata for VANC can go anywhere in the vertical interval, but we do have the additional guidance that this has to go as early as possible to make sure that you have processing time to handle it. So what it tells you is the format of the image inside the frame. It doesn't necessarily tell you what to do with the image, although I said earlier it kind of does. It doesn't necessarily, although typically that's what we do. SMPTE 2016 standard describes the common mappings, the different common ways we map 4 by 3 into 16 by 9 and 16 by 9 into 4 by 3. It also contains something called bar data, which allows a little more fine-tuning of the positioning of the content within the carrier frame, but that's not been widely exploited. So it implies how to handle the picture when you scale it. And it may or may not be what you want, for example. It has to be correct, for example, to begin with, and it must be updated anytime you scale the picture. So if you geometrically modify that picture and don't update the AFD, the downstream equipment is going to make the wrong decision because you gave it the wrong input. You may also use to elect codes in a non-standard way. So these codes allow you to make the right picture, but they can also allow you to make the wrong picture under certain select conditions. So for example, one customer I'm aware of has an HD 16 by 9 feed, and when they downconvert and broadcast in SD, they want it center cut. So they want just to cut the center out of 16 by 9, that'll be the SD feed, except when a commercial comes on. When a commercial comes on, they want full letterbox, even on SD, because although it'll be reduced in size, the advertiser has said, I want the whole commercial on the screen at home. The way they solved this problem was to use the AFD codes in a non-standard way and tag the commercial content with a fib that told the downstream converter to display it as letterbox, even though it might have been arriving inside 4x3. So AFD can be used for other things besides the standard obvious applications. Does not mean automatic, means active, that's the A, but it can be automatic. But it doesn't work without some participation from us. We need to understand the format of the content, obviously. We need to understand the artistic intent. Everybody remembers movies from the old days. What am I saying? You watch your TV at home and you stretch it wide, you squeeze it narrow, that's wrong. There's artistic intent involved. It needs to be respected. You need to understand the devices in your system. There may be devices that don't handle AFD that modify the picture. Bad, bad news. You have to be sure you know about these devices so you can adapt your system to accommodate them. You need to know your system behavior. And you have to understand what you want to deliver. Are you delivering an SD feed, an HD feed, both? And you need to understand what may happen to your signal downstream. And that's getting better all the time because AFD and format information is now making it to the home. There was a time when it left, you know, it looked good leaving here, and you don't know what happened beyond that. So it controls downstream aspect ratio conversion. That's its big goal in life. And if you get it wrong in one place, by the way, it'll be wrong until somebody reaches in and says, oh, it's coming wrong. Oh, somebody buggered the AFD. I'll fix that here. You also got to remember up and down conversion are lossy processes. You want to do as little of this as possible. I mean, we're taking pixels, we're decimating down to a smaller number of pixels, we're interpolating them back up to a higher number of pixels, we're throwing away content. And every time we do it, we throw away a little more content. And it depends on the quality of your conversion. You can't restore that lost information. So AFD can solve your problems and you can up and down convert all you want, but be careful because your picture will go completely to hell and you'll wonder why. Well, it's because you use this tool to be able to not pay attention to what you're doing to the content. So it's really important always to minimize the amount of aspect ratio conversion you have going on. So it tells you the format of the image in the frame. It doesn't necessarily tell you what to do with the image. And the common mappings are in the SMPTE 2016 standard suite. There's an example of down conversion with no AFD. These are sequential frames from left to right. And what we're going to do is we're going to switch the stream from HD full to SD pillar box. And we're going to convert it from HD down to SD and back. And as you can see, what happens is you go from postage stamp to a double postage stamp because you've been unable to convey information about what has to happen to the picture at the far end. With AFD, problem solved. Top picture and bottom pictures are the same every frame because AFD was able to describe the picture mapping on a frame-by-frame basis. Up conversion looks the same. I won't dwell on the pretty picture. Without it, you end up with postage stamping and other ugly things. With it, you can ensure that what you have at the top going through whatever transport that may have altered it comes out the bottom the same way. We bind it to every field and every frame. By the way, why every field? Oh, well, I'll get to that at the bottom. I'll tell you in a second. We carry it in VANC. Devices need to keep a tight association here. If a device does not touch scaling, it should not ever touch AFD, ever, ever, ever. And scaling devices must touch it always, always, always. Very important. Has to be updated frame accurately, by the way. If your AFD update is one frame late, somebody's going to get a flash of funny format as the format of the content changes, for example, between program and commercial. Placement's important. It's got to be in the VANC space nice and early. And on both fields, why? Well, if you have interlaced content and you're converting that from I-30 to P-60, you need to be sure you can carry the descriptions in every frame of the P-60. Does it solve the arc problem? Well, it can. And as many of you know, I'm sure by now it does. Pretty good job. You need to have carefully qualified equipment that works correctly, and it has to do this work in real time. In fixed format streams, you can use fixed arcing devices, but you don't dare anymore in a stream that doesn't use just only one format of video inside the carrier. And you have to have contact paths that are qualified for this. They have to respond to the AFD appropriately. You can't format convert and not update the AFD, for example. They have to be accurate and timely from an end-to-end basis. And you need to know how they're going to behave in unexpected circumstances. If AFD goes away on a commercial, what do? Do you hold the current scaling? Do you go SD? Do you go HD? Do you go to black? Do you throw up bars? Well, you need to know. You need to make a choice and decide what to do in your system when AFD goes away because you're dependent on it, so you have to pay some attention. What about the viewer? Well, this is my mother-in-law. She's got to light all those pixels. She has too many knobs to turn, and I unfortunately was unable to glue the button that says menu on the converter. So her and every viewer in the world are going to turn the knobs anyway. There's not much we can do about that. But it is getting to the home more and more. It is working more and more. And if people don't mess with stuff, it tends to work reasonably well. And until we get totally consistent delivery of the arc data to the set, the problem will remain at the viewer's end. And as long as they have knobs, they're going to turn up the chroma so people are bright orange and then make them purple anyway. Where does it end? Well, there's always going to be an opportunity for aspect ratio to break. You need to ingest legacy content. You need to tag that right. And you need to fix content that's mistagged. And despite our best efforts, viewers still have a knob in their hand. So it'll probably never be perfect, but with care, we can mitigate a lot of opportunities for problems. These are the standards. 2016-1 and 2016-3 are the two main ones of interest. Encourage you to have a look at them if you have any deeper interest. And standardization ensures interoperability. I put on my SMPTE hat again here. And these SMPTE standards are the core of your infrastructure. So it's really important that SMPTE does this work, and it's really important that we take advantage of it. And the LipSync standard, in fact, offers the opportunity to do the same, and we're hoping we'll have the same beneficial outcome from that standard as we do from AFD. It's all about QoE. LipSync and AFD are all about making your viewer happy. Thank you very much. 1 second, unbelievable. We don't have time, I guess, for questions, but we'll have a break, and I'll be hanging about if anybody'd like to chat this up. There's my email. You'll note now it's harrisbroadcast.com, and if you have a comment or a flame or just want to email me and yell, please, by all means, drop me a line. I'd love to talk to you about this stuff any old time or any other SMPTE standard. Thank you very much for your patience and kind attention.